Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Promise Kept, The Muscogee Creek Nation, and McGirt vs. Oklahoma, by Robert J. Miller and Robbie Etheridge, narrated by Janet Metzger. Introduction. On the far end of the Trail of Tears was a promise. On July 9, 2020, Justice Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court wrote these words about the Muscogee Creek Nation, MCN, and its reservation, which is located in modern-day Oklahoma. On that day, the court decided McGirt v. Oklahoma by a 5-4 vote and held that the constitutionally guaranteed treaty promises the United States made to the MCN from 1832 to 1866 were still binding. Consequently, the reservation that was guaranteed to the MCN by those treaties still exists today. Before the McGirt case was decided, the amount of land over which the MCN government exercised sovereignty and governing powers within the state of Oklahoma was about 135,000 acres. Following the court's ruling in McGirt that the MCN reservation still exists, the area over which the MCN has sovereignty is once again the full 3.25 million acres that were guaranteed to the nation in its 1866 treaty. Oklahoma and Oklahomans will now have to deal with the issues arising from the MCN exercising its jurisdiction and governance over this vastly expanded area. Clearly, the McGirt case has enormous ramifications for the MCN, Oklahoma, and the United States, and for other Indian nations and states across the country. Moreover, in the months following McGirt, multiple Oklahoma state courts, applying the same analysis and precedent of that case, held that four other large Indian reservations and three smaller Indian reservations still exist in eastern Oklahoma. Now, approximately 43% of Oklahoma, up to 19 million acres of land in the eastern part of the state, is Indian country under federal law, and 1.8 million Oklahomans, about 90% of whom are non-Indians, have discovered that they live on reservations. The McGirt decision itself held that almost 1 million Oklahomans, including 400,000 people in Tulsa, live on the MCN reservation. The subsequent reorganization of the Cherokee Nation reservation means that Tulsa, the second largest city in Oklahoma, is now located entirely in Indian country, on either the MCN reservation or the Cherokee reservation. These court cases have already led to significant changes in the daily life and law of the state, and have created major issues and questions about day-to-day life and governmental sovereignty and jurisdiction over these areas and Oklahomans. In fact, McGirt has created fear and anxiety for the government of Oklahoma and for some citizens in that state. Governor Kevin Stitt, who is Cherokee, stated on May 17, 2021, "I don't think there's ever been a bigger issue for Oklahoma." Despite its new status, the Oklahoma case is not unique. Other states also have large areas of Indian country within their borders, and Indian nations and state governments have cooperated for decades. For example, 27% of the land mass of Arizona is within a reservation and is thus Indian country. And Indian nations own 50% of the water in that arid state. The 22 Indian nations in Arizona have litigated issues with the state in past decades, and today these governments look to have acclimated to this reality. Through respectful relationships and negotiations, they have entered into agreements and handled many issues cooperatively. Hopefully, once Oklahoma and the Indian nations in that state adjust to the changes McGirt produces, the initial fears raised by Governor Stitt and others will be addressed and ameliorated. In fact, Oklahoma and 39 Indian nations located within it have for decades worked out governance, taxation, and other issues via negotiations and by entering into more than 650 agreements called compacts. But McGirt and the state cases in Oklahoma that have followed, along with the fact that 43% of the state is now Indian country, raise the possibility of significant, wide-ranging, immediate, and long-term impacts on Oklahoma and Indian nations. These changes will present obstacles, challenges, and opportunities for all these governments and their citizens, and will raise issues that will have to be resolved by either litigation or negotiation. McGirt was specifically about state or federal criminal authority over an Indian who had committed a crime on a reservation. Oklahoma argued vigorously to the Supreme Court, and has argued ever since, that the case is crucial because it could lead to thousands of Indian inmates being released from state prisons. The state has continued to be concerned about the civil and tax law implications of McGirt as well. In fact, the Oklahoma Tax Commission released a report 2 months after the case was decided, in which it estimated that the state would lose $72.7 million in income tax revenues each year, face an additional $218 million in state income tax refund claims, and see an annual reduction of $132 million in state sales and use taxes. The outcome for the state's finances from McGirt is potentially so serious that the credit rating organization Standard & Poor felt it necessary to announce right after the ruling that it would not immediately lower the state and county government's credit ratings due to the case. Besides these immediate and critical impacts on the state's criminal jurisdiction and the reduction of state and local tax revenues, the full impact of McGirt on Oklahoma, the Indian nations, and all their citizens will play out over the next several decades and beyond. In the chapters to come, we will examine the history and law in regard to the Muscogee Creek Nation and its reservation, the Indian Territory, Oklahoma, and the McGirt decision, as well as the consequences that have already ensued and those that will likely follow. We have divided the book into two parts. Part 1, A Brief History of the Muscogee Creek Nation, offers an overview of the MCN from its 17th century origins as a political entity into the 21st century, with a focus on treaties, legislative acts, and court rulings that are pertinent to the McGirt case. Chapter 1 lays out the origins and early history of the Creek Confederacy, as it was known at the time, and its relationships with first the British and then the U.S. government. Chapter 2 takes the listener through the removal of the Creeks from the American South to the Indian Territory, which is now the eastern part of Oklahoma. Chapter 3 explores the history of the MCN reservation in the Indian Territory. Chapter 4 delves into the history surrounding Oklahoma's and Oklahomans' encroachments on the MCN, its reservation, and the Creek people, and the presumed disappearance of the MCN reservation. Part 2, The McGirt Case, focuses exclusively on McGirt versus Oklahoma and the Supreme Court's ruling in the case. Chapter 5 examines the 20th and 21st century case law that preceded and set the legal context for the court's decision. Chapter 6 then closely analyzes the case, which agreed that the MCN reservation continues to exist today. Chapter 7 presents a detailed analysis of the legal precedents that control the changes and consequences that are taking place on the MCN reservation and within the other newly re-recognized Indian reservations. We also attempt to foretell some of the unknowns, the issues yet to be defined, that will control and impact the future of these reservations. We conclude with our thoughts and hopes about what the future decades hold for the MCN, other Indian nations, Oklahoma, and the Indian and non-Indian peoples within it, and the United States after McGirt. Fundamental to the McGirt case are the definitions of Indian reservations and Indian country. The tangled history of native and colonizer relationships, however, makes those definitions not so clear. European countries that attempted to colonize North America were interested in building empires by acquiring land and resources and subjugating native peoples. After the founding of the United States, Americans embraced the same goals for the new nation. In fact, in a letter dated September 7th, 1783, General George Washington reiterated these goals and laid out many of the principles that became federal Indian policy for nearly 200 years. Washington was writing in response to a congressional committee request for his opinion on what sort of relationship the new United States should forge with the Indian nations. Washington had eyed Indian territories since he was a young man, and he, along with most Americans, understood that the acquisition of Indian lands would form the national territorial base of the new United States. He was also concerned about waging costly wars with Indians for acquiring their lands. With these things in mind, Washington suggested that the U.S. Congress acquire Indian lands by means of legal purchases through treaties. To delineate the boundaries between native landholdings and those of the states, Washington suggested that Congress draw a boundary line between the new American states and Indian country. But he noted that care should be taken neither to yield nor to grasp at too much. He also encouraged the United States to engage in trade with Indian peoples to fix them strongly in our interest. In his words, "Policy and economy point very strongly to the expedience of being upon good terms with the Indians, and the propriety of purchasing their lands in preference to attempting to drive them by force of arms out of their country, which, as we have already experienced, is like driving the wild beasts of the forest. When the gradual extension of our settlements will as certainly cause the savage as the wolf to retire, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape. In a word, there is nothing to be obtained by an Indian war but the soil they live on, and this can be had by purchase at less expense and without that bloodshed." The lethal nature of this advice is obvious. First, Washington expressly compared human Indians to animals. "The savage as the wolf, both being beasts of prey, though they differ in shape." Second, he voiced two common opinions among Americans at the time, that native peoples were like beasts of the wild, and that the United States would spread across the continent and acquire all native lands. Not surprisingly, as we will hear, the U.S., from its inception as a nation, adopted Indian policies expressly designed to achieve land acquisitions. The policies initially followed Washington's advice for a treaty system dedicated to peaceful land purchases. But when native peoples resisted and the treaty system faltered, federal policies became more coercive, harsh, and violent. In 1849, federal Indian policy for lands west of the Mississippi ostensibly moved away from treaties, but in practice, treaties were formulated until 1871 and even thereafter. Called treaty substitutes, these were negotiated agreements between the United States and Indian nations enacted by the U.S. Congress as congressional laws. The purpose of many of these congressional laws was to establish a reservation system. The reservation era was relatively short-lived, from 1849 to 1887, but it came to define the land claims of many Native nations. The United States has long made other federal reservations of lands that are unrelated to Indian law. In those situations, the federal government removes a specific plot of land from the public domain, the public lands owned by the U.S. for the benefit of American citizens, and reserves that plot as a federal reservation for various purposes, like military bases and national parks and forests. These lands remain publicly owned in a sense, but they have been reserved or set aside for a specific purpose, and the American public has fewer rights in these reserved areas than they might have in the federal lands of the public domain. Indian reservations are somewhat similar, but they differ in significant ways from the federal reservations just mentioned. One difference is that the tribal nation, not the federal government, was reserving the specific plot of land from their tribal domain. In other words, under the reservation system, the federal government allowed a tribe to reserve a small area of land for its reservation out of a much larger land mass that the tribe already owned and governed, and whose ownership may or may not have been recognized by the federal government. The Indian nation would then, usually under some compulsion, agree to sell the remaining territory to the United States through treaties. The tribe retained the reserved plots for their homes, towns, and livelihoods. These reserves became known as reservations, and the lands were held in common by the indigenous nation and not as individual private properties. In a 1905 landmark case, the U.S. Supreme Court, interpreting tribal treaty fishing rights in the Pacific Northwest, recognized that the lands called reservations and the rights defined in those treaties were not gifts from the United States because they were not a grant of rights to the Indians, but a grant of rights from them, a reservation of those granted. Consequently, in those situations, it was the Indian nation and the native peoples who reserved specific rights and reservations for themselves out of a greater pool of rights and lands they had previously owned. In other situations, including that of the MCN, reservations of land are different. For one, the removed tribes, such as the MCN, were not given an opportunity to reserve plots of their original homelands. Rather, the United States coerced them into signing removal treaties, wherein the tribes agreed to sell all of their homelands and move to lands across the Mississippi River that the U.S. had previously claimed and had reserved for the removed tribes, the so-called Indian Territory. These removal reserves, then, can be properly characterized as having been established by the U.S. with the agreement of the removed Indian nations. So, while one might be technically correct to say that the United States did the reserving, the Creek Nation and other removed tribes had agreed by treaty to sell their lands in the East to the U.S., and to remove and accept lands in modern-day Oklahoma and elsewhere. The term Indian country includes all Indian reservations, and it is within these areas that tribal governments primarily exercise their sovereignty, jurisdiction, governance, and authority. State governments and state jurisdiction are largely excluded from Indian country. Consequently, the definition and existence of Indian reservations are crucial to tribal sovereignty, jurisdiction, and governance. The sovereignty and governmental powers of Indian nations are at their strongest in Indian country, and state sovereignty and jurisdiction are at their weakest. In addition, federal power, sovereignty, and jurisdiction are also increased when land, peoples, and events are within Indian country, because this increases the application of various federal laws in this area, and it is where the majority of federal laws regarding Indian affairs apply. Today, there are over 330 Indian reservations in the lower 48 states. In 1948, Congress used a variety of U.S. Supreme Court cases to draft a statute, 18 United States Code Section 1151, to specifically define Indian country for purposes of federal criminal laws. The court has applied this same definition to civil law issues. Under Section 1151, Indian country includes A. all lands within reservation borders, even if some of it is owned in fee simple title by non-Indians, and even if it includes, for example, easements or rights of way for highways, railroad lines, pipelines, and telephone lines. B. Dependent Indian communities, a complex subject that we need not address. And C. all Indian allotments when the land is still held in trust, that is, when the legal owner is the United States and the land is held in trust for an Indian nation or an individual Indian. It is noteworthy that until the McGirt case was decided, most people assumed there were no reservations in Oklahoma and that the only Indian country in the state consisted of small allotments of land that were still owned by Indian nations or individual Indians and held in trust by the United States. Now that the Supreme Court and several state courts have re-recognized 5 large reservations and, to date, at least 3 smaller ones in eastern Oklahoma, there is a lot more Indian country in the state under 18 U.S. Code Section 1151A. The dissent from the McGirt ruling argues that the MCN reservation was disestablished through the General Allotment Act of 1887. We devote much of Chapter 3 to the Allotment Act. In sum, the act was intended to fragment the tribally owned land base by moving all native lands from communal ownership to individual private ownership. It retained the sole right of the U.S. Congress to treat with tribal nations, and it also was explicit that part of the allotment agenda was to dismantle tribal governments and to bring the tribes wholly under federal jurisdiction. When allotment ended in 1934, many Indians in Oklahoma Indian Country had lost their lands in unethical land swindles, which resulted in a checkerboard pattern of ownership by Indians and non-Indians. However, one thing is clear. Although the intention of allotment was to limit tribal and Indian ownership of the lands within reservations, it did not, in fact, disestablish the boundaries of the MCN reservation. Lands owned by Creek people, as well as Creek township lands and other public Creek lands, were still within the MCN reservation. That reservation can only be disestablished through an act of Congress. The United States Supreme Court decides major cases impacting American law and life every year. Some decisions reverberate for decades, like the abortion case of Roe v. Wade in 1973, and the school desegregation case of Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. The court also decides several Indian law cases every year. Some of these decisions might alter federal Indian law or have a major impact on a particular Indian nation. But sometimes an Indian law case drops like a bombshell and creates impacts that take decades to reveal themselves and to be dealt with. McGirt v. Oklahoma is that kind of case. On July 9, 2020, the Muscogee Creek Nation Reservation was re-recognized as encompassing 3.25 million acres in eastern Oklahoma. This entire area is Indian country under 18 U.S. Code Section 1151A. In addition, Oklahoma state courts subsequently re-recognized four other reservations for the Cherokee, Seminole, Choctaw, and Chickasaw nations, and three smaller reservations. Oklahoma now has approximately 19 million acres of re-recognized Indian country in the eastern part of the state, and the renewal of tribal and federal jurisdiction and sovereignty over those enormous areas. McGirt poses crucial challenges for Oklahoma, the Indian nations, and the United States. These governments will have to address and settle a multitude of issues in future negotiations, litigations, and perhaps legislative efforts in tribal, state, and federal legislatures. There is no question that McGirt has already impacted and will continue to impact daily life and governance in Oklahoma for all peoples and all governments and for decades to come. Part 1. History of the Muscogee Creek Nation. 1. The Origins and Early History of the Muscogee Creek Nation. Although McGirt v. Oklahoma explicitly involves contemporary Creek Indians in the present-day state of Oklahoma, to fully understand the import and impact of the case and the promise made and kept, one must begin the story with the origins and consolidation of the Muscogee Creek Nation, MCN, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. The MCN originated in the present-day states of Alabama and Georgia when the pre-colonial Native South was fundamentally transformed during the crucible of contact between natives and Europeans. Scholars have identified some of the forces for this transformation, things such as military losses and cultural exchanges with early explorers and Spanish colonizers in present-day Florida, the introduction of Old World diseases, and the consequences of political and economic incorporation into the modern world economy through a trade in Indian slaves, animal skins, and guns. Across the Native South, people had myriad responses to these historical forces, from violence and resistance to accommodation and negotiation. Natives' lives changed from living in a purely Indian world to living in a multicultural, multiracial, globally situated colonial world. A region-wide political restructuring of the Native South ensued, and the pre-colonial Native polities of the American South transformed into the large Indian nations of the 18th and 19th centuries, the Creeks, Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, Catawbas, and others. Scholars call these early emergent tribal nations coalescent societies, so named because they were all, to varying degrees, coalescences of people from various fallen pre-colonial polities of various languages and kin groups, from multiple regions, and so on. The MCN, known as the Creek Confederacy in the 18th and 19th centuries, was one such coalescent society, and its origins lie in the deep history of the Native presence in North America. This is not to say that Creek history unfolded only when Europeans arrived on the scene. In fact, North American Indian life has undergone many transformations since the initial peopling of America some 15,000 or more years ago, and contact with Europeans was but one of many historic events that initiated profound changes in Native life. Discussions of Indian origins usually begin with Native origin tales. The Muskogean origin narratives tell of the original Muskogeans emerging from an opening in the earth and a subsequent migration from the west to the east. The point of departure is vague in the narratives, an unnamed place, although usually located west of the Mississippi River. The group was forced to...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?